This is Seattle's Morning News. Let's talk about housing and rents with a man who knows all about them, Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. The monthly housing report for January is up. And let's just start talking about rents, because that's what people are worried about. There's so much building going on in Seattle. And according to free market economics, the more capacity there is, the more downward pressure there should be on rents. So are we seeing any downward pressure on rents?
Interesting. You're talking about the classic Econ 101, supply-demand. Add on supply, you've got a finite amount of demand. That can actually function to lower prices. Have we seen that now? No, we haven't. And there's lots of different reasons for it. Predominantly, we've seen constructions, a lot of cranes. I think we still have more cranes in Seattle than any other city in America. But those projects actually started back in 2012, 2013. So we're not seeing 1 year where we see a massive jump, but we've just seen a continuous growth and evolution in the apartment market. Now, why have we not been seeing rents go down? Great question. We've got a lot of supply. However, at the same time, we still seem to have very significant demand. We're creating a lot of jobs downtown, certainly a lot of technology-based jobs. These are people that don't want to live out in the suburbs, do want to live in that urban environment. And for right now, we seem to be almost in equilibrium. But that said, I have noticed over the last probably close to a year, more signs of concessions. Now, what concessions are is a business will say, you can rent my apartment, I'll give you 1 month off rent, or I'll give you several free months of parking. So when you start seeing that, it's interesting. That does tell me that everyone's fighting for the same tenant. And so because of that, I expect to see not so much rental rates drop, but certainly a fairly significant rate in rental rate growth.
Okay, so for people looking to buy or sell, it looks like prices have gone up year over year substantially.
Yes, they have. I mean, if you look at it, what's interesting is a couple of things, one of which in King County, you've seen prices up by almost 4.5%. That might not sound very much, but it was you and I talking probably 6-7 months ago. Year over year, it was negative.
Yeah.
Some people were thinking, okay, this is going to be great. House prices are dropping. It was a blip. I said then that was going to be the case. That is clearly shown in the numbers. So belief the market is there. It's certainly come back. A number of listings, there's nothing to buy. And what we have seen, certainly in the month of January, whereas a lot of people tended to wait until later on in the spring before they decide we're going to start looking for a house, they've really come hot out the gates January 2nd. Mm-hmm. So a lot of demand, but no supply.
Really?
Because there's no supply, pending sales dropped, obviously.
So limited choice. So Seattle year over year up 3.3%. But look at this. I mean, Snohomish County up 12%. Pierce County up 15%.
Exactly. And again, something we've touched on several occasions. It's that drive to buy. Most of the jobs certainly are being created in King County and mainly in Seattle. We'll probably see 30,000 jobs in the county this year. There's a value to our time. We'll pay more to live closer to where we need to be. That's forced people further and further out. Historically, they went up to Snohomish County. Now what we're seeing is that they're looking south because, as you can see, there is clearly a delta in price between Pierce County and Snohomish County. So I think you're going to see greater interest and demand for housing. But what's going to be the consequence? What's going to be the cost?
Okay, as an economist, let's talk about the other factor that seems to have the stock market gyrating. That's coronavirus. For a while there, investors were freaked out, and then people started realizing, well, wait a second, the ordinary flu is way worse than this, so what are we freaking out about? And
right.
So they freaked out in the other direction. What impact is this likely to have on Washington State, given all the trade we do with China?
I would say at the present time, I'm not that worried about it. I think there could be certainly a lag effect. And I'll be honest with you, we talk about what worries me about Washington State. I'm more concerned about the 737 and recertification there, significantly so, than I am about coronavirus. Now, certainly there's a lot of freaking out. But let me give you a comparison. If Boeing does not deliver commercial aircraft in Q1 because of the issues they've got, that can reduce U.S. GDP by over 0.2%. So we're not talking about something that just affects Washington. It can actually be demonstrative of slow down the U.S. economy. So I think that's more troublesome. I think coronavirus, we've had other issues, Hunter virus, the bird flu, and these kinds of things in the past. We've got through them. I think we'll get through this one, but it's a classic whiplash mentality. Wall Street does that. Something happens, they immediately pull back, which they did, and then realize, it's not a death knell, and they start moving forward again. So, yes, we do. Obviously, China is our major trade partner. We export more to China than any other nation in the world. And so it will be interesting to see over time what effects there could be. But quite frankly, on a dollar basis, I'm not seeing it as something that can really put significant headwinds in terms of growth in the Washington state economy.
Yeah. So let's talk about the 737 MAX crisis. If it is that big, I mean, this one aircraft is affecting the entire country. What's the effect going to be on the local area? Is that going to, at some point, does that end up, let's say, depressing housing prices here, as the legendary 1970s Boeing bust
did? Absolutely. 1972, last time people left Washington State was 1973.
Yeah.
So because of the Boeing bust. A couple of things, one of which is I watched last week. I was immensely happy to see the 777X take off.
Yes.
That was spectacular. It's going to be going up against Airbus in a very, very big way. For the twin aisle jet market. So that was a good thing to see. I think they will recertify the 737, probably the FAA, likely in the next 3 to 4 months. So it's going to happen. So is it a big issue? Yes, it is. Does Boeing need to kind of get its ducks in line in a far more demonstrative way? Absolutely, they do. So I think they're going to get there. Although Boeing themselves are being very cautious and saying, you know, we're not sure when that's going to happen.
Right, which is good.
Which is good. However, at the same time, the FAA said perhaps Boeing is being a bit overly cautious.
Overly cautious now? Well, in this current climate, that's probably better.
So I think ultimately when we talk about housing, we've already seen people being moved out to California, to Moses Lake, to take care of the existing fleet. We are starting to see some layoffs in other aerospace associated businesses. One up in Arlington, I believe, has just announced layoffs there until such times as they start selling things to Boeing again. However, in the bigger picture, has it got the capacity? No. And the reason for this is very simple. Boeing, without a doubt, is remarkably important to our regional and our state economy. Dollar basis, by far our biggest exporter of aircraft. However, at the same time, what was different between now and 1973 is the diversification that we've seen. Boeing was created, 1917 in South Lake Union? We went where they went. Until the 70s. And then as they were starting to refigure themselves out, there was a little podunk two-person office in Albuquerque, New Mexico, trying to figure out computers. Well, they became Microsoft. Right. So I think it is that diversification which can be very protective to our economy regionally. Certain. And I never like it when any one market relies on one company or one asset class.
Look at Detroit.
Exactly. Right. They lost.
We lucked out up here.
They didn't create a job for 10 years.
It was fortunate that both Bill Boeing and Bill Gates decided they wanted to put their companies here. Windermere Chief Economist Matthew Gardner. Matthew, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington. An evergreen playground blessed.
And every week at this time, to help all the newcomers talk like quirky locals, we present historian Felix Bonneau with a feature we call All Over the Map, a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And this week, once again, we blame Captain Vancouver for yet another blunder, the misnaming of Hood Canal.
Yeah, we always pick on Vancouver for failing to notice the Columbia River. But back in May of 1792, Captain Vancouver came across the entrance to a body of water, ended up being a long channel stretching about 50 miles from the lower end of Admiralty Inlet down to the Great Bend and then turning up to the northeast for about 11 miles. He wrote in his journal, early on Sunday morning, "We again embarked, directing our route down the inlet, which after the Right Honorable Lord Hood, I called Hood's Channel." Now, we'll get to who Lord Hood was in a moment. So Vancouver wrote that in his journal, Hood's Channel. On the chart, it was mistakenly written as Hood's Canal. And that was the name that stuck. The U.S. Board of Geographic Names officially accepted it. They dropped the possessive S off around 1917, so it became Hood Canal. So that shorter version, people have been using that name for a while. Now, people didn't like that word canal because it's not really a canal.
No.
It's a channel or an inlet. And there were two efforts by state legislators back in 1947 and 1951 to officially rename it Hood Inlet because they thought they were leaving tourist money on the table. If people wouldn't think, like, the name Hood Canal didn't match up with the scenic beauty. I mean, you've been there. You know how gorgeous it is. It's a natural inlet.
I mean, it connoted locks and dams and things like that.
That's what you expect. You expect to see sort of industrial things being dragged along the side, but that wasn't the case. And both those efforts failed. And just for whatever reason, it's just stuck, and we're stuck with the name Hood Canal. Now, the Right Honorable Lord Samuel Hood was a big naval hero in the Revolutionary War, and some would say that was for both sides. Place name expert James Phillips says Hood was called the Englishman who won the war for the colonies because of his failure to pick up Cornwallis's troops as prearranged, thereby leaving the general to defeat in the decisive Battle of Yorktown. I'm not a big Revolutionary War expert. That sounds pretty damning.
So he's famous for screwing up.
But he helped us win, apparently. He also signed the instructions for Vancouver's expedition, so he was sort of not the author of the journey, but he's definitely an important figure for what Vancouver was doing here in the Northwest back in the 1790s. One quick final fun fact. Mount Hood is also named for Lord Samuel Hood. And I came across a map just last week. It's in the Library of Congress collection, published in 1826. It shows the Mount Hood that we all know and love there in Oregon, but it also shows where Mount Rainier is, a second Mount Hood.
What?
On this map from 1826, there's
two Mount
Hoods.
They're just named all the mountains after the same guy?
Yeah, and that's the only map like that anyone knows of. I've checked with a couple scholars, like Mount Rainier experts. No one's ever heard of this before, but for a while there, there was two Mount Hoods in some people's mind. And we'll have that at My Northwest later, but please don't use that map to go exploring this weekend. You'll get into trouble if you go looking for both Mount Hoods.
Felix Bunnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thank you, Felix. The coronavirus has now killed more than 600 people, most in China, including the 34-year-old doctor who first reported it and was punished by the Chinese authorities. And that was a little disconcerting, the guy being only 34. In the U.S., there are very few confirmed cases, 12, in fact. But just in case, Washington State now has one of the few places where people under quarantine can stay, and our own Hannah Scott got a tour.
So this quarantine site is near North Bend, just off I-90. You travel about 6 miles up a windy mountain road and hidden deep into the forest, you'll find it, the Washington State Patrol's Fire Training Academy. The State Health Department has essentially commandeered the dorms at that training facility to use as the state quarantine site for the coronavirus. But the State Patrol's Chris Loftus, during this tour yesterday, says there's no need to panic. In fact, their message to the public surrounds the three C's.
Coordination. This is a coordinated activity with the Department of Health, who is the lead agency in anything related to the coronavirus. Cautionary. The actions we're taking here are caution. There's a very good chance that this will not be needed at all, but we would be remiss if we weren't ready for anything that might be coming our way. And then the third is calm. All the scientists are telling us that the chance of this being a medical problem or a medical issue in the state of Washington is very low.
And as far as the facility?
This fire training academy, as you all know, is remote. It is separated from population centers. It is owned and operated by the state, by the Washington State Patrol. And it is a secure location, so it answers the immediate needs that the folks at the CDC and others needed for this type of facility. There are other locations being considered. They're being evaluated and considered if there is a need that exceeds the capacity here, or if they find a location that serves the needs of the medical community even better than this one does.
Now, some people in the North Bend community had expressed concern about this being set up around their, you know, where they live. Mm-hmm. First of all, there's no patient. There's nobody there yet at all. They just opened this up basically yesterday. And he says that the really important thing to remember when we're talking about a quarantine site.
Not exhibiting symptoms. Of
people who are there are not exhibiting symptoms. So people who would be brought to that facility are people who would be flagged for travel reasons or whatnot. And maybe they don't have a home where they can self-quarantine, so they'd be brought there for, I believe it's 14 days, to watch for any symptoms. And there's a kitchen. It can hold, there are 20 rooms. Some of them have doubled up bunk beds, so if you had family members, you could all stay in one room.
Well, who'd be up there with them? They'd have to have a staff of doctors, I guess.
The State Health Department staff will be there. They were not there yesterday, but that's who will be up there managing all of that. There's no medical facility up there. It's not like that. If you're sick, you have to go to the hospital and you'd be isolated and taken to a hospital. You would never make it to that site. So that's the idea. And that's really the point that they want to get to the public, is that there's nothing to worry about at this point.
We want to emphasize that the risk of this that this virus poses to the citizens and the visitors of the state of Washington is quite low. However, we've got to take reasonable precautionary measures and prepare in case a quarantine facility is needed.
And I mean, and that's the gist. Should there be a massive spread? Should there be an issue? You got to be ready to take some people in. So it's a starting point in case we do have some people who need to go to that space and have their time run out while they're watched.
By the way, do they still have the airplane fuselage mock-up there?
I did not see because I was just in the dorms, but I will tell you that they have all the other training, and that's an important point, is still going on, right? So basically, the fire recruit class, I think they said it goes for 12 weeks. The new recruit class was 1 week in, and the health department said, nope, we need this for the coronavirus. So now they're all in hotels, those recruits, but they still come and do the training at the rest of that site.
Right, so they do disaster training up there, right?
Yeah, and live fire training.
Mm-hmm. The chemical spills and the whole thing.
All of it, yeah.
I've actually heard, I mean, we used to hike up there a lot. I heard like explosions there from time to time.
Well, and they do. They do live fire exercises up there. As a matter of fact, I got an invite to something in the summer that up there at the facility from some of the fire folks yesterday.
Is it highly secret? Can you tell us about
top secrets? stuff, but some of their summer training that could include some interesting things like that.
Yes. Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here is movie man Michael Medved with the latest DC Comics movie, Birds of Prey.
This all started when the Joker and I broke up. It was completely mutual.
And this is sort of somehow somewhat a sequel to Suicide Squad, which was a big flop.
Don't remember that one.
Suicide Squad had the same characters, led by the Joker, who we all know is up for multiple Oscars this time. Hope he doesn't get them. But the Joker in Suicide Squad was played by Jared Leto, and his main squeeze, his girlfriend, is Harley Quinn, played by Margot Robbie, and she was actually the best thing in Suicide Squad, which was a very dreary, difficult movie to watch that really tried to go darker than any comic book movie before it. This one is also incredibly dark. There is, from beginning to end, lots and lots of sadistic violence, but this is sadistic violence with a difference. Every male character in this film is loathsome and deserves to have horrible, violent things done to them. And all those horrible, violent things are done. They're done by a group of women who become the Birds of Prey. The actual title for the film is Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
You just betrayed him. You just killed his BFF. And you're dumb enough to be building a case against him. So unless we all want to die very unpleasant deaths and let Loma go finger fishing in the kid's intestinal tract, we're going to have to work together.
Now, Margot Robbie's up for an Oscar this year for her role in Bombshell. She is an absolutely wonderful actress. She was nominated for an Oscar for the Tonya Harding movie.
Right.
She produced this film, as she produced the Tonya Harding movie. I mean, she's 27, something like that. And she's obviously prodigiously talented. But boy, is she ever wasted in this movie. And her performance doesn't work in any sense. She has kind of an off-again, on-again New York accent.
Yeah, I heard that. It didn't. I don't know of anybody who talks that way in New York.
And again, it's not consistent. And part of the film is supposed to be funny. It's very dark humor. The only humanizing touch that they have for the Harley Quinn character is she loves egg sandwiches that are made in a certain way, and there's a lot of emphasis, and then she will interrupt her eating an egg sandwich to kill various people. These are women who are all victimized largely by an evil genius played by Ewan McGregor, and his name is Roman Savoyas. And he tortures, and he's trying to get a huge diamond that has been swallowed, don't ask, by an abused kid. And so Harley Quinn ends up putting together a group of avenging women. There's one very good performance, which is kind of a star-making performance, by a young actress whose name is Journey Smollett-Bell, who is Jussie Smollett's sister.
Oh.
She plays a singer called the Black Canary. That's her super heroine name in the film. Her action scenes are very well done. Her nightclub singing scenes are very well done. She is great on camera and on screen, and she's a magnetic and radiant presence. And one positive thing in a very, very dreary movie, there's another superhero who's introduced, the Huntress, who's played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead.
What is the Huntress's superpower?
She has a crossbow. Margot Robbie is a truly wonderful talent. I mean, and when she is good in movies, as she is most of the time, she can be very, very good. I hope that she doesn't continue with this Harley Quinn series. They are very clearly setting up for a sequel here. And that seems to me more like a threat than a promise.
How many stars?
Two stars.
Two.
Some of the action scenes, I think, are well choreographed. And again, Journey Smollett-Bell is a strong screen presence. And parents, it's rated R. because the F word is deployed at least 100 times. I think people can afford to miss. I want to get the full title correct. Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
Two stars.
Two stars for one Harley Quinn.
Right. Michael Medved, thank you.
You bet.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now, brought to you by Mike Novak. Enlist with Novak.com. I don't know if you've heard, Dave, but we've got a new lineup on Cairo Radio.
What is it? What does it involve?
Including Tom and John in the afternoon, right? 3 to 7.
What are they doing in the afternoon?
And Ursula and G, 9 to 3. So this story actually comes from the new show, 3 to 7 on Cairo Radio.
Wait, there was a dose of kindness during Tom and Curly?
Yeah. So I think my kindness infection is spreading on Cairo Radio.
I've got to hear this.
I know. So anyways, that set up all to say that John Curley had this dose of kindness to share. Whoa, consider me blown away. His path to kindness begins Wednesday night as he leaves work and encounters a byproduct of all this rain, a big old pothole.
And bam, I hit this giant pothole. And then I look over because I got the super duper new Mercedes and it's boop, boop, boop. This light comes on and then it shows that I've gone from 32 pounds per square inch to 22. I'm dropping. And then all of a sudden I'm at 4 and then bang, I got a flat tire. So now I pull over to the side of the road. I curse the city of Seattle. I'm screaming because that's a giant hole in the road. Fix it. That's your job.
He's angry, bitter, yelling in vain at the city. And he's telling this story, adding sound effects, rain, to help put us in his shoes on this harrowing night that he gets a flat tire on his brand new super duper Mercedes. And things take a turn for the better.
I'm screaming at the city of Seattle. And all of a sudden,
yeah.
This guy comes by and goes, hey, need some help?
Uh-huh.
And I said, yeah. And then I turn around, and another guy to the right of me. Another guy to the right. Now there's two guys standing there, Tom.
Good Samaritans to the left of you, to the right of you.
And sure, yeah, the rain still keeps falling.
Yeah.
And these two guys change the tire.
Two guys stop to change his tire. Not one, two. What would make two people stop? Because you see somebody already helping someone, you think they're fine.
Why didn't Curly change his own tire?
Yeah, he tried. I had to cut that part of the story. He was trying. He really tried.
He couldn't get the lug nuts off? Or
clearly, these two guys thought he was struggling because they stopped to help him, right?
Couldn't find the jack?
I guess not.
I thought the Mercedes had an automatic change my tire button. You just press it.
Yeah, or an automatic
changes its own tire.
I don't know.
Jeez.
Well,
in the
nice.
End, though, he gets curious. What would cause not one but two men to stop and help a complete stranger?
And I said to the guy, why did you do this? Two great stories. The one guy says to me, I'm 26 years old. When I was 25, they found I was vomiting blood, coughing up blood on Christmas Day. I went in. They found I had large cell lymphoma. I had a tumor the size of a grapefruit in my lungs. And I said, if I survive this, go through chemo and everything, I'm going to be a better person, and anytime I have an opportunity to help somebody, I will. That's the one guy. And the other guy, he's got a New York Giants hat on. He says he was grew up in Bronx and had a tough life, and no one loved him or cared for him. He just said the world should be a better place. We should look for one another.
There you go.
Wow.
Don't you love it?
So does this mean John is a changed man? Because if that's the case, it's going to ruin the show.
I think the show will still be, the show in spirit from 3 to 7. But I'm just
That's
happy that doses of kindness can now be found at all times on Cairo Radio.
So this is a Saul type conversion.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. On his way to Damascus, Sammamish, I guess.
He's no longer a tax collector now. He's a prophet.
Yeah.
Coming to us live and direct from the G and Ursula show, here's G Scott wearing his shiny inflatable vest.
For the floodwaters, Dave.
I haven't seen one like that, but that is a flotation collar, huh?
Yeah. Gets it done, brother.
Nice.
No. Yeah. I pulled it out. I was like, Dave's going to like this morning. I knew you would.
That was nice.
What's going on?
The NBA All-Star Game is coming up on February 16th, and I figure we ought to talk about it just in case we actually get a team someday. We have to at least keep the spark of basketball excitement alive. But yesterday you said you don't care about the product anymore.
I don't care about the product. I care about the stars, right? I care about the opportunity, the ability to be able to see these stars. I love LeBron James. He's my favorite athlete, pro athlete of all time. I would love to see him play right here in Seattle. I would love to see James Harden play. And there's, even if you're not really a fan of like every single team in the NBA, that's okay. But it is nice to see one of your team, or maybe your kids or your nephews or somebody in your family that loves the NBA and some of these players. That's what we're missing here in Seattle. It'd be great. I mean, it'd be great to have the Sonics here still. I've missed them so much. Can you believe it's been 10 years?
Who could say next year we get our NBA team? Who could we draw here?
Who could we draw
here? Yeah, what stars could we draw here? Or has it been so long that Seattle's had a star team that players would be hesitant to come here?
Well, no players would be hesitant to come to a city with, or a state of Washington where there is a lot of money.
Right.
There's a lot of things going on here. Look at the Cranes, downtown Seattle. There's a lot of economy that is happening here. But as far as the team, I don't know how the team would be to start off with, Colleen, but all of the teams would have to come and play here, and that's an opportunity to see these teams. The Houston Rockets come.
Does the NBA have a parity policy like the NFL does?
No. That's why NFL is king, right?
Yeah.
The NBA is kind of, you know, every single year, it's kind of down to about six teams that you think are most likely going to win the championship. One of those teams happens to be whatever team LeBron's on. Right?
Yeah.
That's going to be one of them. Or over the last few years when Steph Curry and Kevin Durant and all those guys were there, you knew that they were going to be some of the top teams. That's why the NFL is so king, because at any point someone could come out there and win. The San Francisco 49ers won 4 games the year before, and the next year they're in the Super Bowl. The Rams were in the Super Bowl last year, and then they don't make the playoffs the next year. So you just never know in the NFL, and that's why it's designed to keep us coming back and watching it.
By the way, what do you think about sports betting, which apparently, I know they've got an organ already.
Can't stand it.
Really?
Can't stand it.
Because I feel the same way. I still don't like the lottery, for that matter. I just think it's a way of ripping people off. But, I mean, you can't stop it, right? I mean, it's popular. People just can't figure anything better to do with their money.
There's an emotion that is tied around sports. It's an emotion where you're like, why are you yelling at the TV? Why are you screaming? Well, you take that emotion, right? And now you harness that and you go say, hey, I can go and make my rent. Hey, I can go and pay for my kids' private school because I know sports. Let me go to that casino and let me go ahead and try to make my $500, $2,000. There are people that can afford and have disposable income. That is not going to hurt them.
Yeah, right.
I'm talking about the folks that are living paycheck to paycheck.
Exactly. That's what I don't get. Don't they learn at some point that it doesn't work?
No. Because, Dave, you know what? I just thought about something. Have you ever gone and done a payday loan?
No.
I have.
Why would I do that?
Because
the interest rate is like 30%. Why would I do that?
Because you probably, well, I won't say why would you do that. Let me tell you why I did. Because I was desperate, man.
Yeah.
I needed money.
Yeah.
And yeah, you don't really think about that. You don't care about the fact that it's going to be 20 to 30% until
you're there.
It's time. No. Once you get it, you're good.
Yeah.
But once it's time to pay back, and once you pay back, you realize how stuck you are with that. So anyway, I'm speaking for them. I'm looking out for people, which is a lot of our country, that are living paycheck to paycheck.
We got to talk about that sometime. Because in my situation, if I'd been that desperate, I'd have called my parents. Because when I was started out, I was poor. I mean, I was making, $8,000 a year, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I had parents fall back on if push came to shove. I would never have to get a loan.
What if you didn't have parents?
Yeah.
I'm asking. Like, what if you didn't have parents to fall back on?
I have no idea. I guess I'd just go on the streets and hustle.
Oh!
But we're out of time.
We got to talk more about that.
G. Scott is joining up with Ursula at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. This is Seattle's Morning News. What do you do when someone you work with triggers a very strong emotional memory that you can't immediately control? Let's consult with licensed mental health counselor Ali Sokolow. Ask Ali, sponsored by ProClub, the region's premier center for health and wellness. The example that you proposed was your boss reminds you of your ex-husband. Well, what is it? First of all, what is triggering look and feel like?
If you walk into a room, and this happens sometimes, when you walk into a room and you meet somebody and you talk to them for a couple of minutes, and all of a sudden you might hate them and you don't know why. And all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, this is a feeling I've known before, but I don't know why. And so you go home, you think about it, and it's like, I've met this person before, but you haven't. It's a different person, but there's a strong resemblance, whether it's how they talk, how they walk, what they look like, that reminds you of someone that hasn't been healthy for you.
And I would think at the very least that just going through that process means you cannot concentrate on what that person is trying to tell you.
Oh, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And so you're stunted by this feeling and you have no idea who you're talking to at that point.
Hmm. All right. So
what do we do?
What do you do?
The first thing I say is, what's the difference between that person and we'll use X as an example. What's the difference between that person and the ex? How do they cope differently than the person that you were with before? How are you different with this person? Can you communicate better with this person than you did with your ex? What are the things that you can control in this situation versus what you couldn't control with your ex?
I mean, could it be something as superficial as the way the furniture is arranged in the office or something?
That's a good place to start if they're stuck. I mean, yes, if you want to start from ground zero, that's a good place to start. You know, look at the settings. Where are you now? This is not your home fighting in the kitchen. This is at work talking about something business related, non-emotional.
So you're reasoning with yourself, saying these are all the reasons why this really isn't my ex-husband.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's no meat cleaver within reach.
Yeah. And really identify what it is that triggers you about the person. Because since they're not your ex-husband, is it their tone of voice? Mm-hmm. Is it the way they ask you questions? It could be as simple as they're just condescending like him. Well, we can handle that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of people can be condescending,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
I would think, though, that no two people are exactly alike. So over time, wouldn't the boss more and more resembled your ex-husband less and less?
That's a great question, because sometimes it's not about the person itself. It's about the situation you're in and how that person reacts in that situation. So you could have known your boss for years and you guys encounter a new situation together and you see how they handle it, and that triggers that feeling from your ex. Yeah. So yes, over time, if you're triggered by someone initially, over time you may feel better about them naturally. But the worst part is when you've known that person for a while and they do something and you're like, ooh, I don't like that.
Yeah. Now, the word triggering itself has gotten a bad rap. I mean, it implies snowflake. I mean, it implies you're being oversensitive. Is that fair to say in situations like this?
It is unfair, because it's not people being overly sensitive about something. It's something from their past that they've experienced, that they felt a certain way during that time. And it doesn't mean it's rational for you because you haven't been through that experience, but it's rational for them based on what they've been through. So we have to be sensitive about that.
So this is not something to be dismissed as mere weakness when somebody feels this way.
Absolutely. And you see people handle, we'll take tough bosses as an example. You see people handle tough bosses differently all the time based on their own previous experience with tough people. And so some people can handle that better than others because they have sort of a cleaner history with people with tougher personalities.
And what if, despite your best efforts, that feeling still rises up in you every time you see this person?
I think that if you have really tried to work on yourself and handle the situation differently, gone to counseling, maybe it's not a good person to be your boss.
Yeah.
And maybe
it's time to move on.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't torture yourself forever.
Allie Sokolow, licensed mental health counselor. Thank you, Allie.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.